Hi, welcome to this week's program. Remember the first time you heard about the stock market? I'm sure it got the adrenaline up for many of you, excited about picking stocks with dreams of doubling, tripling, or 10xing your money. The early days when you hadn't tasted your first loss of capital and you were completely unaware of the dangerous pitfalls of inexperienced, untrained, and overconfident investing. It's almost like a rite of passage where the market quickly hazes newbies and shows them that it's the one that's all powerful. So, for those of you who are new to investing, let me give you some tips on how you can keep from getting burned by the market. First, now the basics of investing sound really simple in theory. Buy low, sell high, that's it. How hard can that be? Well, you'll be surprised. To make money with this simple strategy, first you have to know what low and high really mean. And remember, in the stock market, when you buy, someone else is selling. And when you sell, someone else is buying. So what you may think as high as a seller of shares would probably be considered low enough for the buyer in that transaction. So are you really smarter than your anonymous counterparty? See what I mean? How different conclusions can be drawn from the same information. So because of this hard-to-pin-down relative nature of the market, it's important to study a bit before jumping in because it's really never as simple as buy low and sell high. I always say that investing is simple, but it's not easy. So before you start investing on your own, I do believe you should read up on basic accounting so you understand terms like revenue and revenue growth, operating expenses, operating margins, operating profit, earnings per share, you know, stuff that's on the company's income statement. And you need to know about the balance sheet as well, the terms like cash and total assets and total liabilities, current liabilities, book value, those kinds of terms. You also want to understand terms like working capital and cash flow, so you're in a slightly better position to truly assess a company's financial position before you jump on someone's recommendation to buy a hot stock. You also need to know about price-to-earnings ratios and so on. You have to understand how they get calculated and what their major weaknesses are. Very important when you compare a company's stock valuation relative to its fundamentals, relative to its competitors or the market as a whole. And while you're learning, it's always good to start out by using virtual money in a stock simulator. Most likely, you'll find that the market is much more complex than a few ratios can express, but learning those and testing them in a demo account can help lead you to the next level of study. Let's talk about playing penny stocks and fads. You know, at first glance, penny stocks, which literally cost less than a dollar per share, seem like a great idea to invest in. With as little as $100, you can get a lot more shares of penny stock than the popular companies like Facebook that cost about $135 a share, or Google that costs $830 a share, right? And you may be tempted by a sizable upside if a penny stock goes to a dollar. But remember, a penny stock is a penny stock for a reason. The market doesn't believe the company warrants a higher valuation, and the company may not offer much future gain. So what penny stocks offer in position size and potential profitability may reflect high volatility and really poor expected returns. So even if you buy a stock for 50 cents, because it's more highly volatile, you can end up losing your entire 50 cents should the company tank. And that risk is much less than a Facebook or a Google. Penny stocks are also exceptionally vulnerable to manipulation. You know, getting solid information on penny stocks can be very difficult because many reputed investment companies simply do not follow them, making penny stocks a poor choice for an investor who is still learning. So beware. Penny stock pushers would love to con you into thinking that they're the path to riches, and while that's true extremely rarely, most of the time people have lost big on penny trades. As a matter of fact, on Facebook, now I see ads for the promise of making millions on penny stocks of companies involved with the commercialization of marijuana. You know, there's no easy riches, and most who get into this are going to lose everything. And it's been said, there's a sucker born every minute. So overall, I prefer you own a quality stock for a long time than try to make a quick buck on a low-quality company. We're talking about the dangers of investing, especially for first-time investors. Here's another one. Investing 100% of your capital in a specific investment is usually not a good move, even with a Google, a Microsoft, or a Facebook, because even the best companies can face issues down the road and see their shares decline dramatically. While you might have more upside if you go all in and the company does really well, you'll also have a lot more risk. Especially as a first-time investor, it's good to diversify and buy at least a handful of stocks. This way, the lessons learned along the way are less costly, but still valuable. You know, it's been said that investing or learning about investing costs money. Either you go to school and you learn it, either you hire an advisor and have a professional do it, or you do it yourself and lose quite a bit of money. And usually that third choice is the most expensive of the three. Here's another dangerous move is leveraging your money by using margin. Using margin means that you borrow money from your broker to buy more stock than you can afford. Using leverage magnifies both the gains and losses on your investment. So here's an example. Let's say you have $100 and you borrow $50, so you buy $150 worth of stock. Stock rises 10%, you make $15. $15 on $150. But that $15 is actually $15 on $100, which is a 15% return on capital. Pretty good, right? Now, if the stock declines 10%, you lose $15 or for a 15% loss, even though the stock only declined 10. More importantly, if the stock goes up by 50%, you make a 75% rate of return. That's pretty good. But if the stock declines by 50%, you're left with $75. Now, from that $75, you got to pay back the $50 that you borrowed. That leaves you with just $25. That's a whopping 75% loss of invested capital. So as a new investor, make sure you don't get lured by the siren song of margin and its potential for higher rates of return. Now, talking about investing cash you can't afford to lose is another dangerous move. Studies have shown that cash put into the market in bulk rather than incrementally has a better overall return. But this doesn't mean that you should invest your whole nest egg at one time. Investing is a long-term business, and staying in business requires having cash on the sidelines for emergencies and opportunities. Sure, cash on the sidelines doesn't earn any returns, but having all your cash in the market is a risk that even professional investors won't take. If you don't have a lot of free cash beyond your emergency cash reserves, really, stay out of the market. Putting all your money on the line makes you emotionally vulnerable and leads to investing with what is called a behavioral bias. It's a handicap, which almost predisposes you to making bad decisions. So only invest money that you can truly afford to leave in the market for long periods of time. All right, finally, whether it's trying to guess which stock will be the next Apple, investing quickly in a hot stock tip, or going all in on a rumor of earth-shaking earnings, investing on new tips is a terrible move for first-time investors. Remember, you're competing with professional firms that not only get information the second it becomes available, but also know how to properly analyze a company's performance before it announces results. Rather than following rumors, ideal first investments are companies that you understand and have a personal experience dealing with. As good as Warren Buffett is, he always invests in what he calls his circle of competence, meaning he sticks to what he knows and what he understands, and you should do the same. So remember, when you're personally buying stocks in the market, you're competing against large mutual funds and institutional investors that not only do this full-time, but also have far more resources and in-depth information than the average person. Temper your expectations, start small, take measured risks with your money, with the money that you're prepared to lose, and then after you read up and become more adept at evaluating stocks, start making bigger investments. While it's tempting to bet the bank to try to make a quick buck, real money is made by slowly compounding your returns over several decades of disciplined investing. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. As part of the human distress that has unfolded in South Texas, and as we here in South Florida are looking at possible repercussions from Irma, we've decided to do a segment on what to do after a hurricane hits. And I've invited Greg McBride. You know, Greg has been on the show many times. He's a certified financial analyst. He's the senior vice president, chief financial analyst for Bankrate.com, and he's with me here to discuss what to do. Hey, Greg, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so there's kind of a list of things. A lot of them are common sense, but some of them are not. So let's start with what you should do. This is after the storm. What's one of the first things that you should do?
Well, you know, certainly be on the lookout for, you know, any type of damage that needs to be documented. Protect your property, secure it, and realize that there's going to be power outages that are widespread. So, you know, having access to hard copies on your documents is going to be helpful in dealing with insurance adjusters that may be on site, or just having access to cash so you can buy things.
Yeah.
A lot of times after a storm, you're back to a cash-only economy for a while until power is restored on a regular basis.
You know, hopefully you have pictures of your precious stuff. I mean, I have, you know, a lot of musical instruments in my home, and I've got pictures of them. I got some art that's important to me. So I'll make sure to, you know, have pictures of that. So insurance companies really love that stuff. And also make sure that you keep all your receipts for purchases made after the storm, because you're going to want to go for reimbursement on those, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That gets a little bit tougher if you're, you know, dealing, you know, with, say, a store that doesn't have power, or they're running on like backup generators or something. They may not be, you know, running everything through the regular cash register and printing out receipts, particularly if they're only accepting cash.
Yeah.
But whenever possible, absolutely secure those.
All right. What about your insurance company? You know, there's different insurance companies. There's your home insurance, your car insurance, and then flood insurance. You know, you should really have those telephone numbers handy, and you should know what your coverage is, right?
Yeah, know what your coverage is. Know the policy numbers, too.
Oh.
You know, how many times where, you know, you call and the first question they ask is, well, you know, either an automated system or a live human, the first question they ask is, what's your policy number?
Good point.
You know, having that file that contains those hard copies, or at least copies of that important information, I think is really, really vital at a time like this. And, you know, Steve, you mentioned flood insurance. And I mean, you know, that is the one that, you know, particularly with Harvey, so many people that don't have flood insurance are really in a difficult spot, because what a lot of people don't understand or find out too late is that, you know, your homeowner's insurance policy doesn't protect against flooding. It may protect on water that's coming down through the roof, but not water that's rising up. That's a separate policy.
Yeah.
And it's not escrowed through your mortgage payment like your traditional homeowner's insurance policy. It's a separate premium that you have to pay. So I think a lot of people should really take another look at this flood insurance. And, you know, yes, the premium is not something to sneeze at, but an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And, you know, a lot of our friends in South Texas, you know, they're wishing now that they had made a different decision regarding flood insurance earlier.
Well, talking about South Texas and the terrible flooding they had there, you know, what happens if your house gets blown down or your house gets totally damaged beyond repair? Here was a question that, when I was researching this, that came up. Should you continue to pay your mortgage, even though you don't have a house anymore for the mortgage? And I think the answer is yes. You must continue to pay your mortgage. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. I couldn't jump in fast enough on that one. Yes. You know, because the mortgage company is listed as a loss payee on the insurance claim. So eventually, you know, that mortgage will get paid off via the insurance settlement. And then you can sort of move on with the process of, you know, either, you know, rebuilding or securing another residence. But in the meantime, absolutely, because your credit history goes on, and you know that mortgage, until a loss payee's payment is received from the insurance company, unfortunately, those monthly payments are due. Same goes for the car as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, the idea, though, is that most mortgage companies, the big banks and others, you know, they'll make some kind of alleviate your pain a little bit when it comes to maybe payment if there's no electricity for weeks on end or something of that nature. But you know, a delay of payment can still hurt you, but, you know, make sure that your bank is going to accommodate you for that. But think long term when it comes to these things.
Yeah, they'll give you often a temporary reprieve, late charges. You know, particularly mail doesn't operate for a while after a disaster. Like you said, power is out for an extended period of time. You can't make those online payments. And so late charges are typically waived. You know, in extreme cases, they may even defer for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But in your terms, you know, thinking long term, mm-hmm. the payment is still going to have to be made at some point to kind of bridge the gap until the insurance pays it off.
Yeah. So, you know, FEMA comes into the mix here a little bit because FEMA does offer grants to fill in the gaps between insurance payouts and SBA loans. So the maximum grant is $33,300 per household. And that's for disasters that happened in the fiscal year that ends September 30th, 2017. So just by the skin of our teeth, because the news reports now is that FEMA's running out of money. I don't think that that's something that's actually going to happen because it's backed by the federal government. But nevertheless, you can get some temporary funds through FEMA, and I think that's important to know.
Yeah, they actually have an app you can download to your phone. You know, probably good to have that.
Mm-hmm. That's great advice.
Charge on your iPhone, maybe your only connection to the outside world of power is going to be down following a storm.
Here's another thing. This, again, is, you know, your home is damaged, you've got flooding, whatever it is. Be on the lookout for mold, because mold is extremely dangerous to you and your family's health. And you want to learn how to spot mold beginning in your house and learn what to do to remediate it. Any points on
that? That's one where you want to catch it sooner rather than later, too. So, you know, the earlier you can catch that, you know, the better off you're going to be. And, you know, a lot of us have seen the TV footage in Southeast Texas of you know, people that are ripping out flooring and drywall and mm-hmm. things that are just piled up by the curb. A lot of that is to get that stuff out of the house so that you don't have the accumulation of mold.
All right. Finally, what about raiding your 401k if you need cash? Is that a good idea?
No, it's not a good idea. That probably doesn't surprise you that I say that. However, the economic reality for a lot of people, particularly you know those in Texas that didn't have flood insurance or others that weren't adequately covered, is you know that may be their only option. But just understand the consequences of this. You are dealing a permanent setback to your retirement planning.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple ways to go about it. You can either borrow from it or you can take a hardship withdrawal. Borrowing is the lesser of two evils because at least there you're paying the money back to yourself, the interest back to yourself, to your own account. But you're going to miss out on the growth of that money over time. And then you also lose tax efficiency. The time you spend putting money back into the account is time you're not putting new dollars into the account. So it's a permanent setback to your retirement planning, even if you're just borrowing rather than taking an all-out withdrawal.
Well, we do a lot of preparation as well as we can to get ready for hurricanes. There's the before, there's the during, the hunkering down and the worrying and trying to make sure everybody is safe. And then there's the after. And what we've been talking today with Greg McBride about is the after, what to do after a hurricane. Greg, thank you so much for joining us. Greg is the chief financial analyst for Bankrate.com. Thank you so much.
Pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
To hear this conversation again and to join our conversation at our website, don't forget to go to stevepomerantz.com. Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomerantz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Growing up is expensive. When young adults want to get married, that may mean a lavish wedding to kick off the partnership. Also, buying a house could require a bigger down payment than the money they have in the bank. So, as a parent, how can you help them without jeopardizing your own retirement? I've invited personal finance journalist Marilyn LaPonzi to join me today to discuss just this. Welcome to the show, Marilyn.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
All right. So this is part of your article that I really liked. Young adults can earn scholarships for college, but there is no scholarship for retirement. What does that actually mean to adult parents that are trying to save and help at the same time?
It means that parents are often, they're so concerned with the idea that they're going to have a 40-year-old living in their basement that they're not thinking about the fact that they could someday be a 70-year-old living in their 40-year-old's basement.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
There's just, once you hit a certain age, you know, time is not on your side and you can't be saving for retirement. Mm. And so it's great to help your kids, whether that's college or a wedding or a house, but you need to be thinking about yourself and you need to be putting yourself in a good position, not only for yourself, but also to help your kids going forward.
The college savings bit is, it's a four-legged stool. I mean, you're exactly right. You have to understand that they have their whole life ahead of you. You have less than them. Let's just put it that way nicely.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a time crunch on your side and there's less of a time crunch on theirs. So, you know, college expenditures can come from your savings as a parent. It can come from some of the work that they do while they're in college. It can come from student loans. It can come from different sources other than purely you saving the entire amount for yourself, especially if you can't do both effectively, right?
Yep, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And people need to also remember they think they're doing their kids a favor by helping them pay for college or helping them buy a house, but you could actually be doing your kids a disservice because if you aren't preparing for retirement, I mean, you think about long-term care costs and someone who needs to go into a nursing home or they need assisted living, that could cost $100,000 a year easily.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have money set aside, if you don't have insurance, your kids are going to be the ones that are picking up that bill. And then they're not going to be able to save for their retirement, which means that their kids are going to be picking up the bill for them when they're retired. So what you do right now, if you don't save for retirement, I mean, it could affect your grandkids and your great-grandkids. It's a spin-off effect that goes for generations.
You know, I think that's an excellent point that we really never think about, but the fact that these financial situations can affect many generations hence, where people basically get tied into almost a poverty cycle or a near-poverty cycle because of decisions that perhaps were made many generations ago. And this is one, I mean, maybe that's an extreme way of putting it, but it's kind of an example just to remember that by, if you're in retirement and you don't have enough money and you can't leave any money behind and your kids are helping to pay your way, then who's going to take care of them if they can't take care of their own retirement and the cycle continues? So you want to break the cycle.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you're saying.
Yep, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you know, this idea of saving, so there's numerous ways to save. The way a typical adult saves this day and age is in their 401k if they're working, or they're building IRAs. Maybe they own their own business. They set up a pension plan for themselves. That's a very good way to save. Or just taking, you know, extra money at the end of every month and socking it aside and just building a taxable portfolio of maybe index funds or something of that to try to get some growth throughout the years. So let's take some of those. So in terms of saving for college, let's start there. What are the best ways for parents to put some money aside for their college-bound children?
Well, one of the best ways nowadays is to use a 529 plan. You know, I know we often think about savings bonds as being the traditional way to save for college, but all states have 529 plans now. These allow parents to put aside money. The parents own the money. They own the account.
That's
they name
important.
Their child as a beneficiary.
Right.
The money doesn't have a tax deduction when it's put in, at least not at the federal level,
mm-hmm.
but it grows tax-free, and if it's used for college expenses or qualified education expenses, it can be withdrawn tax-free.
Yeah.
And some states will give you a tax deduction for their particular, so if they're resident, is contributing to their 529 plan, they get a tax deduction. So that's one of the best ways. If you know your kid's going to go to college, you know, that is a great way to save.
Yeah.
It comes with tax benefits. It can count against you in the financial aid formula.
Hang on. Well, let's get into that in a minute. But let me just kind of reiterate what you've just said, which is very important, that the money is owned by the parents.
Yeah.
Unlike some mm-hmm. other accounts where you're actually gifting the money to the children. And, you know, when they turn age of majority, which can be 18 or 21, depending on your state, then it's theirs to do whatever they want. And that has some risks to it. Also, if the child does not go to college, it can be moved to a second child, right?
Yep, absolutely.
And it can be used for education expenses. But if it's not used for education expenses, the parent can get that money back subject to some taxes and a penalty, right?
Yep, absolutely. You can still get that money out. So if none of your kids go to school, if you don't have anyone else, you don't have grandkids, you can pull that money out. You will pay some tax. You'll pay a 10% penalty on it as well. The one exception is, you know, if your kid gets a full ride scholarship, then I think there's provisions that let you take it out tax-free. But most of the part, you will pay that penalty, but it's better than losing the money.
Yeah, well, that's it. And so there's a degree of liquidity to the money, and that's a powerful financial tool, is to make sure that your money is liquid. So what do you do if your children come asking for a loan or gift? What do you say to them?
Well, hopefully you have thought about this in advance, especially if your kids are getting to the point of being young adults. Hopefully you've talked to your spouse if you have one, and you have looked at your budget and you've decided in advance that, you know, my child wants to go to college and this is what I can afford. Because you don't want to be put in a situation where your child is coming to you and you suddenly feel that guilt, like you have to help them.
Yeah.
Or you don't know, or you just have no idea how much money you can afford. So you're like, oh yeah, sure, I can cover that. Don't worry about it.
Right, right.
So a lot of this is, you know, part of just looking at when your kids are teens, you know, 15, 16, 17, start keeping that in mind with your budget so that you are not caught off guard when that discussion happens.
We're not only talking about college, but we're talking about a wedding, or we're talking about them wanting to buy a house. I mean, these could be expensive propositions. Especially these days, weddings are incredibly expensive. And I guess there's this tendency, you know, to go, you know, I'll take care of that, you know, because maybe it doesn't seem like that much, or you figure I'll pay it out over time, or I'll figure it out. But that can be quite risky and dangerous to your own personal retirement.
Yeah. And it's tough because, you know, you want to say yes to your kids and you want to support them.
No, there's all that guilt, right?
Yes. There's a lot of guilt involved in being a parent. And you think you can make up for all the mistakes.
Oh,
by, you know,
that's right.
Just, like, pay for that great wedding, or yeah, help them buy that house.
Yeah, because after all, everything was our fault. You know.
Yeah. So. That's the way it feels like sometimes.
I know it does. Yeah, so, you know, it's like there's this unwritten requirement to help out, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But there isn't, you know.
Yeah.
That's what parents need to remember, is that you don't have an obligation to help. Mm-hmm. And some parents don't. I mean, some parents are, you turn 18 and you are on your own.
Yeah.
You know, I tend to think that it's good to help your kids transition.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to decide what is right for you and your family. And what is your personal comfort level? You know, do you want to help your child with college? Do you want to help them with a house? Where do you draw that line? But even if you can afford it, I think parents need to be very aware of the lessons that they're teaching their children.
Yeah.
And maybe you can afford to pay all your kids' college costs. And maybe you can afford to gift them a house. You know, you're doing that well off. But you need to think about, what lesson am I teaching my child?
Yeah, well, there's this thing about having skin in the game, you know?
Yes.
And that's very important. I mean, some people say, look, my only obligation is to raise kids to be happy, healthy, and well-equipped to function in the real world. And, you know, that is a great idea. But too much money can kind of subvert that idea to something less desirable. So your desire to help, perhaps your guilt, kind of gets in the way of you doing what's best for them. It's kind of ironic, but actually it seems to be the way it works.
Yep, I agree.
Yeah.
Yep. So parents need to keep all that in mind. I mean, it's really complex. You know, I mean, it's not just a simple mathematic equation of, I can afford X and I'm going to give my child that.
One idea that you wrote in your article is a Roth IRA. And I thought it had some positive ideas. You don't get a deduction for putting money into a Roth IRA, but it does grow tax-free.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use it for retirement, or you could pull it out for college as well. So that sounded like a really good idea. The only problem is that you really can't contribute that much to a Roth.
Yep, that's right. And that's one of the big limitations with that strategy, you know, is with a Roth, you can only put in $5,500 a year unless you're age 50 or older, and then you get an additional $1,000 for catch-up. So that's $6,500 a year. And then there's income limits, too. So if you're a single taxpayer, once you hit $118,000 a year, mm-hmm. your ability to contribute to a Roth starts to phase out. And there are some backdoor ways around that. But, you know, by the letter of the law, once you hit that amount, you can't necessarily put in the whole amount. So even if you start when your child is born, you know, I did the math, and for 18 years, that gives you $99,000 that you could pull out in your contributions, which sounds like a lot. But, you know, a lot of private schools are now $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year when you consider room and board plus right. tuition. I mean, that's the sticker price, and hopefully your child is going to get some assistance, so you're not paying that much. But $99,000 doesn't get you very far,
not
especially
anymore.
If you have multiple kids.
Yeah, not anymore, that's for sure. We have numerous articles on our website about this subject. We discuss kids, we discuss paying for them, and we discuss retirement quite a bit. So go to cpomerantz.com to get those articles. Also, don't forget, when you go to the site, make sure you sign up for our weekly update, which tells exactly what's been on the show and gives you summaries to read if you don't want to listen, and gives you all kinds of access to what we're doing here at the Steve Pomerantz Show. My guest is Marilene LaPonzi, and she's a financial writer, and we were talking about paying for yourself as an adult and also doing the right thing for your children. Thanks so much for joining us, Marilene.
Thanks, Steve.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker, located in sunny, partly sunny, Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Sure. So home prices keep climbing, but sales are not keeping pace because why? There's no inventory.
There's
you
no
keep telling
inventory,
us that.
That nasty little word. And yeah. It is so true, Steve. We keep saying low levels of inventory, low levels of inventory. I'm going to tell you something crazy. I just looked in my particular, you know, city of Boca Raton, just wanted to see what you could find under $300,000 in a single family home. Mm-hmm.
One.
That's it. One. I'm not kidding. I'm not even exaggerating.
Wow.
And then I went to some neighboring cities staying east, and there was like two others. So when I say shortage of inventory, I really mean it. And it really is most prevalent in the lower price range.
Yeah.
So the problem we're having is there's no inventory for first-time home buyers to purchase.
Mm.
We're down like 17%, a really high number.
They're still building huge amounts of rentals in our local area. I mean, downtown Boca Raton, they're putting up these kind of skyscrapery type buildings. Almost all of them are rentals. And I guess that's the reason why. But I don't understand why builders aren't taking advantage of this opportunity and putting up shanties or whatever they can put up there. What's going on?
Well, it goes to there's no land. And,
yeah.
you know, the cost of land is expensive. So, you know, a builder has to look, well, if it's going to cost me X amount of dollars to purchase this property, where's that number? You know, what price point do I need to sell the units, homes to make a reasonable profit? So that's what we're seeing.
What is the median existing home price for a single family these days?
Yeah, right now it's about $255,000 across the country.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it keeps rising.
How much higher is that, let's say, from earlier in the year?
Well, we're looking at, say, the first quarter, it's up 10%,
mm-hmm.
and it
That's
represents a 6% rise from the second quarter of last year.
Wow.
So it's a steady climb. I was looking at some other statistics, and if you look at appreciation, the forecasts are 4% next year, and then it'll start to taper down a little bit, 3%, 3%, 3%, maybe 2%.
Okay.
So we have, you know, many years ahead of us of appreciation. outside of, you know, some extraordinary economic influences, we're going to continue to see growth. Demand is certainly outpacing supply, and there doesn't seem to be light at the end of the tunnel.
So the most expensive areas in the country are the San Francisco, Silicon Valley type of areas. I don't think that's any surprise. What are some of the cheapest towns in the country, and what are those houses going for?
Sure. If you look at Youngstown, Ohio, that's about $87,000. Cumberland, Maryland, $98,000. Decatur, Illinois, about $107,000. And Elmira, New York, about $112,000. Those are the places you want to move to.
So, Terry, but there's plenty of money available for people to borrow to buy these houses, and people are actually putting down less money than they ever have.
It's true. 20% was the norm. And now what we're seeing the past years, actually about 1.5 million borrowers purchasing with less than 10%. See, basically what's happened, Steve, is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac has brought back the 3% mortgages. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are just taking advantage of that, which is not a bad thing.
No, I mean, you know, I think these mortgage companies, I think the Fannie Mae's of the world, have better data now to be able to figure out who's a worthy buyer or not. I don't think there are any more of these liar loans where, you know, people, they put a mirror up to someone's mouth to see if they were misting the mirror, and that would qualify them. I think all that's over with, but it makes you a little nervous.
Right. And keep in mind, these are first liens. These are mostly single mortgages. They're not second mortgages.
Yeah.
And you still have to have a strong credit score. Actually, they're up about 50 points more than they were during the 2004-2007 years. So they're stronger and healthier.
Mm-hmm. There was some interesting information that you gave me about when you're buying a house that's been flipped, a flipped house, there's some questions you should ask. I think this is incredibly important because it's kind of like when you have a rental car, you know, that you don't really take care of it as good as you take care of your owned car.
Right.
And I think it may be the same for a flipped house. So what are some of the questions you should ask?
Well, the absolute first question is, who is the seller? Is it an individual or is it an LLC? Well, you say, well, why is that so important? Well, some people use what they will call it a one-off LLC to purchase a foreclosed home. They'll renovate it and then sell the property. But the problem is, after they sell it, the LLC is then liquidated. So then months later, when the buyer finds out there was a defect in the property or with the title, then the LLC has no assets and then is no longer in existence.
Yeah,
so you have no one to go back to.
Yeah. So think about that. First of all, it means limited liability corporation. So they have limited liability.
Right.
And if they create an LLC, you know, for the purposes of handling the money of this flipped house, and then they go out of business or they just close it, you got no recourse. That's big.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, one way to see if you're buying a house and the LLC was just formed, I'd be probably a little leery of it. Mm-hmm. But if it's an LLC that's been in existence for a long time, then there's probably, you know, less to worry about.
Well, we are out of time, unfortunately. My guest, as always, is Terry Story. Terry is a 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker, located in Boca Raton, Florida. And she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, PomerantZ.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Is there such a thing as failing in retirement? Can a person who has successfully navigated their life to finally reach the stage of rest and relaxation, can that lead them to become an utter failure in the one thing they've been planning for so many years? It's a good question, and one that Bob Laura, founder of the retirementproject.org and Retirement Coaches Association, has written extensively about, and he joins me today. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Hey, Steve, how are you?
Hey, you know, I read a lot of financial planning and investment articles, and they mostly focus on the math of financial planning, you know, investment rates of return, charting your financial course, probability analysis, and so on. But you look more closely at the emotional impact of these aspects of our lives. And in a recent blog, you quoted a woman who had written to you, and this is really what got me interested in having you on the show, because it really moved me. I'd like you to read an excerpt from what she wrote you.
Sure. And stuff like this comes across my desk on a regular basis, and when it does, I definitely want to tune into it. But the lady wrote, "I never had trouble with low self-esteem before retirement. I always associated my worth with what I did and or being needed, not just being. That was a big mistake. I am no longer needed in my relationship. I was a good corporate wife who stayed home to raise her son so Bill could focus on his career. Now that he's retired, I'm not needed the same way, and the kids are grown, so I'm no use in that function either. When Bill was working, I was the person who held down the fort. But those days are over. I'm no longer needed because he is here all the time. I know he used to be so proud of me and happy about my performance, but no more. And of course, I'm not doing all those things he needed for me in the past. I have an active outside life, a healthy self-esteem there, but not as a wife. This can't be so unusual, I guess."
Wow. That's a very grievous statement. It's a kind of a real emotional, kind of a sense of depression in that language. What did you make of that?
Yeah, you know, you can feel kind of the anguish that she has. And so I think it's really, you know, helping people kind of understand and kind of to figure that stuff out, you know, because really it doesn't get talked about enough, but because everyone pictures retirement as this perfect picture time where everything is just happy and perfect, but she's really grieving the loss of her role. She used to be a mom. She used to be a corporate wife, and that's gone. And there's really, it's not a simple process.
Yeah.
Who do you really turn to talk about like stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a vacuum that can be created, and it takes time to figure out the next part of your life and how you're going to fill that vacuum. I think this process is pretty natural. You see it across the board, or is this something that just a few people seem to experience?
No, it happens all the time. And that's the power, I think, or the opportunity for, I think, whether it's financial professionals, human resource people, just, you know, friends in general, to help people, you know, to recognize this, to help them see that, hey, this can be, retirement is a difficult transition. There are things that you're going to lose that may take time to replace. And so by just making people more aware of it, and in this situation with this lady, when I said, you know, it sounds like you're grieving the loss of your role,
yeah,
it created some awareness for her that she just had not kind of put grief in tune with what was happening to her.
It's a sort of disenfranchisement. You're no longer part of the world that you were. Is that a particular kind of grief? I mean, once you've recognized it, that you can start to work with?
Yeah, you're spot on with it. It's actually referred to as disenfranchised grief. And if you think about grief normally, it's typically associated with losing a loved one or maybe something like a divorce. But, you know, in the case of retirement, it's not honored the same way. People can't empathize with you the same way they can when you lose someone. And so when it's disenfranchised, it's not honored, but it doesn't take away, and feelings aren't right or wrong, so it doesn't take away from how that person is feeling. And again, the opportunities to open the door for them to really talk about their situation, talk about what they're missing, because that's a big part of restoring the situation and finding ways to move on and replace that piece.
So this grieving process, what can one do in order to reduce it? I know you wrote that at first it feels like a 100-foot wave is crashing on you, but over time, it becomes a 50-foot wave, and obviously it reduces over time, though you say in your writing that it never really goes away, and that's a good thing. But what can you do?
Well, I think finding support, and whether that's family and friends, and again, I think a big part of it is restoring it, you know, so writing a journal. And again, as you go through these tough times, you actually become an expert at them. So sharing what you're going through with other people, and then eventually when you get to a point to kind of coach other people, it repositions you to do that. And I think the other thing is you can honor the situation by, you know, again, putting a booklet or articles or a blog or teaching a class on the different things. You don't have to, in the past, one of the big myths about grief is you have to forget it and move on. That's not really true. You can maintain a bond, and over time it becomes, you know, something positive instead of something negative that you can leverage in your life.
All right, so we've been talking about grief, but I want to get to this idea that it is possible to have retirement failure. So what would constitute a failure in retirement? It doesn't seem possible, actually. You know?
let
me say this first. You know, you spend your whole life trying not to fail. You're going to fail at certain things, but then you pick yourself up and you start all over again, as the song says. But retirement's not supposed to be about that. It's supposed to be about living, you know, your one best life now that you don't have those kind of constraints.
Right. You know, but it's like any other phase of life, whether it's having kids or marriage, going off to school, whatever the case may be. There's things you have to adapt to. That's a massive vacuum that happens. And don't get me wrong, there are plenty of people who make a smooth transition, but they understand what it's take. They plan beyond the dollars and cents. And so the issue with retirement is there's so much focus on the positive aspects that nobody thinks about the negatives. What's going to be removed? What do I have to replace? What's this going to feel like? And again, one of the biggest issues you see out there with people is socially, you know, who are they going to connect with? And you're still best friends with your friends at work, but they're working and you're not. And so a lot of dynamics play out. And again, there's just vague assumptions is probably the biggest thing that people just kind of assume, hey, this is just going to work out and be great. And that's just not how it goes.
My guest is Bob Laura. He's founder of retirementproject.org, and he's a retirement coach and head of the Retirement Coaches Association, so that's why he knows this stuff. Bob, you described four of the root causes. You know, a lot of the discussions center around the symptoms, how I feel, but they don't talk about the root causes, and you've identified four of them. Tell us about them.
So the first one, as I mentioned, is vague assumptions. Kind of the piece there is people kind of assume, oh, when I retire, I'm going to volunteer, I'm going to do this and that, and then they get there, and it doesn't turn out to be that way. So they just kind of make these assumptions, or work part-time from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. with no weekend work or holidays and make a good living, you know.
Yeah.
That stuff doesn't work, and so it's really about the opportunities to put practical, concrete things in place to know where you're going to volunteer, because you may decide to volunteer at the local hospital, but just the work isn't rewarding.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
You want to do that trial and error, or you may find a job that you don't like, or you have to work weekends, and so going into it with good expectations is important, not just kind of assuming it's going to work.
Yeah, I want to go back to this idea about the kind of things you think you're going to do when you're going to work part-time after retirement. You said it, you went by it fast, I want to repeat it. You know, you may think, hey, I'm going to work 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Thursday, you know,
right.
And you know, the world doesn't necessarily work like that. You know, the jobs you may find may not even exist. So you're going to have to change your expectations. So this is all under the idea of the root cause is that you start out with vague assumptions and you want to get, I guess, more specific and find out, I guess, if you were active in business or in art and you achieved something and now you're ready for retirement, you probably know how to organize things and to look ahead a little bit and to write some things down. The second root cause you mentioned is role ambivalence. What is that?
That's just where this primarily happens with married couples at home, you know, where now that you're both at home and retired, do roles change? And if so, how do they change? And how do you even talk about it and orchestrate it? And how do you reciprocate and honor each other's space and their routine?
Uh-huh.
And then I think the other role ambivalence is, you know, you don't think about bullying or peer pressure when it comes to retirees, but, you know, as you get closer and all of a sudden you feel like, well, gosh, I'm 65. Am I supposed to retire? Well, gosh, I'm 65, and now there's a buyout offer. And you can feel pressured into different situations. And so this mental tug of war takes place. And that, again, is why you want to start to develop these concrete plans. You want to have a financial plan so that you know your numbers and where you stand, so that when these situations come up, you don't have to be confused. You can be prepared to take action.
There's some peer pressure here, too, because if you're of retirement age and now many of your friends are retired and they're going, hey, Bob, why are you still working? I don't understand.
Right.
And you're like, yeah, why am I still working? Well, I kind of like it, but you know, I should be playing golf with my buddies more often or something like that. So there's that kind of issue like peer pressure. I thought only, you know, middle school and high school, but peer pressure. Right. You know, I had a 90-year-old client who basically would not tell her friends her age. And I said, why wouldn't you do that? She says, because they'll treat me differently.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, she's 90 and she's still worrying about that stuff. Well, that got off base here. But let's go to talent and skill reversal, because now if you come home and you're a CFO and you go, okay, I'm taking over the bills, I'm reorganizing the house, right. That's got to cause some problems.
Well, it disrupts the routine. And again, we live in a strength-based society. So use your strengths. Do what you're good at, right? Well,
yeah.
At work and at home are two different scenarios. And so you really have to take a look at, you know, what life is going to be like and step back and kind of say, you know, that's not going to necessarily work. And so it's being really mindful and conscious of your own situation as well as the other people around you, because, you know, again, you know, a mechanic can fix lots of stuff. Well, he can't fix his health problems. And so really understanding where you can plug in and do the good things is important. And again, this is why I really suggest people consider retirement coaches, because it's not easy stuff to talk about or figure about. But if people go in prepared, or at least aware of it, they know how to manage the stuff better.
Yeah, that's a very good. You have a good statistic here that 70% of pre-retirees think that life will be better in retirement, but only 40% of actual retirees find that it is. Very, very interesting dispersion there. So finally, poor communication is the fourth root. Tell us about that.
Yeah, like, you know, I think one of the issues for most people is they have these great ideas in their head, but it never makes it to their mouth or a piece of paper. And that's fertile ground for arguments, disagreements, and not being on the same page. And again, whether it's, you know, with a couple or a single, divorced or widowed or widower and their children and grandchildren, really is about taking the time to tell people what's going on. And also recognizing the stuff you're going to be talking about with this transition to retirement isn't a one-time conversation. It could take multiple, it could take months to kind of figure some things out, but it's about starting that process and moving things from what you're thinking about to what you need to say and share and write down.
Good stuff. Good stuff to avoid being a failure in retirement, if there really is such a thing. My guest, Bob Laura, founder of retirementproject.org and Retirement Coaches Association. Bob, what website can you be found at?
Retirementproject.org. Got all sorts of stuff. It's got our book, Naked Retirement, which is about the non-financial aspects. My new book, Retirement RX, which is kind of a chicken soup for the soul. But that's the best place to check my stuff out.
Sounds great. Thank you so much for joining me, Bob.
Thanks, Steve.
To hear this conversation again, don't forget to go to stevepomerantz.com, and all the links are there for Bob's website, as well as his books and other things as well. So once again, stevepomerantz.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. As Bob Dylan, our recent surprise Nobel laureate, once said famously in a song, the times, they are a-changin'. There was a time when working hard and following the rules almost certainly guaranteed a comfortable retirement. But that very American dream of a blissful retirement free of financial worries appears to be slipping away for more and more Americans, especially those who don't follow the rules. And you know what I mean when I say follow the rules? I'm talking about simple things, like making a budget, managing your expenses, consistent saving and investing, and keeping track of your job-related benefits, and sticking to your plan. Today, most U.S. households are heading for a worse lifestyle and quality of life in retirement than they enjoyed while they were working, despite bringing in reasonably good paychecks. And this is, woefully, because they simply aren't saving enough. 35% of U.S. households in their prime-earning years have nothing saved in retirement account and no access to a traditional pension plan, and that's according to an analysis by the Federal Reserve. You hear what I said? Prime earning years, they have nothing saved in a retirement account. Among households that do have some savings, the typical amount is $73,000, which is about 15 months of household income. That's not enough to take you through retirement. The only group that doesn't have to worry as much are the richest 10% of households that have more than $400,000 in retirement accounts. The low retirement balances mean the majority of households, that's about 52%, are at risk of having to cut their spending after entering retirement. So for most Americans, things don't look that good, which is a pity because I believe the American dream is still achievable by most Americans if they can just get their basic financial planning in order and stick diligently to a plan. And let me add this. I've been practicing as a financial advisor for 35 years, and I've seen many success stories. People with modest jobs and paychecks who, through wise financial planning early in life, conservative spending, and prudent investing, are now millionaires. These people are positioned to live a rich lifestyle in retirement, free of financial worry, with tremendous peace of mind and more money in the bank than they'll likely need. And that's what I want for all of you. So you see, the problem isn't that Americans aren't making enough, it's that they aren't being diligent enough about retirement savings. Now, in light of our recent election, let me also say this. This retirement anxiety stretches across political affiliations. Nearly equal percentages of Democrats and Republicans say they're not managing their retirement planning very well. Okay, so that said, the fault doesn't wholly lie with American taxpayers. This looming retirement crisis is also a result of a system that has increasingly put workers in charge of saving for and managing their own retirements. Data shows that the top 10% of U.S. households made more than $162,000 last year, and that's up 6% from a decade earlier after adjusting for inflation. For middle-class Americans, incomes have barely stayed ahead of inflation, and lower-income households are now making less than they were a decade ago. So, with traditional pension plans increasingly becoming extinct, it's even more important for Americans to save on their own. And if you're counting on Social Security, which is the last line of defense for many people, it's barely going to be enough to support you as you age. So, to help close the gap, states are trying their own measures. In California, they recently passed a law requiring employers to automatically enroll their workers in a state-run retirement savings program and deduct the money from each paycheck, and the early results are very encouraging. But the bottom line is that the onus still lies on you for making these important changes in your financial life, which may make all this retirement pain avoidable. You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomeranz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomeranz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomeranz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.